Hello and welcome to World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Will Bain with you today. Great as always to have your company. Coming up on the programme, France has another new Prime Minister, but does it have a new economic direction and any chance of finding political consensus for that direction? We'll be live in Paris in just a moment to ask just that. Also today, fracking for gas, not normally seen as the most environmentally attractive source of energy, but could tech used to frack open doors for new, greener forms of extracting energy? The International Energy Agency thinks so, and they'll be telling us why a little bit later on the programme. And if you're celebrating Christmas, have you got your shopping done yet?
The consumers wait and see more than they've ever done before. They still haven't really decided until it gets into December. It is really a balance of knowing what to stock, when to buy it. You know, you do hope that you get the numbers right at the end.
Yes, we'll hear from those suppliers and retailers hoping that tight personal finances still allow for a splurge this holiday season in Europe. Plenty to get to then today, and we're going to kick off in Europe, where after days of trailing on this programme amongst other places and will they, won't they's, France does now have its fourth Prime Minister of 2024. It comes after the French President Emmanuel Macron nominated François Bayrou as the latest to be tasked with finding a budget that addresses the country's economic challenges while still appeasing a fractious political backdrop. Here's the man himself speaking to reporters in the past couple of hours.
I think everyone understands the difficulty of the task. I think everyone is also thinking that there is a path to be found which will unify people instead of dividing them. I think that reconciliation is needed.
Some task ahead then. Let's get more, first of all, on the new Prime Minister from our Paris correspondent, Hugh Schofield. Hugh, tell us a bit more then about Mr. Bayrou.
Mr. Bayrou is a fixture in French politics. He's a centrist. In fact, you could almost say that he was Macronite before Macron came along, because back in the early 2000s, when he was running for president himself, Bayrou, he was coining the phrase, you know, neither left nor right, but down the middle and uniting the best of, you know, the right and the left. So he was kind of a bit of a John the Baptist for Emmanuel Macron. And since Macron came to power, they've been close allies. Bayrou decided not to run in 2017 in order to back Macron, because he saw him as a sort of like-minded figure. And they've been very close. So he's a centrist and in general backs what Macron has done. But he does have his own agenda and his own political party and his own temperament, which particularly now may begin to tell, because we definitely sense that, you know, Macron's star is fading, and it's a chance. The reconfiguration of powers in France is such that the Prime Minister is becoming a much more important figure.
Yeah, some John the Baptist-esque diplomatic skills still needed, it seems, looking at the very early reaction from the different parts of the parties that make up that very fragmented French Parliament.
Yes, and you know, on the economic front, we can say what we like about François Bayrou's personal position, which is generally quite pro-business, you know, centre, definitely leaning to the right on business matters, and the debt and the appreciation of the importance of bringing down debt has definitely been part of his long-standing political creed. But that's all very well. The question is, you know, what will get through Parliament? I mean, that is all that matters. And the question that is still completely dominating the horizon is whether a budget which is even marginally kind of restrictive on spending and, you know, lowering state output, spending on the state and putting up taxes and so on, whether that will get through this, as you say, incredibly divided and angry Parliament.
Right, yeah. What do you see then as the sort of budget elements that are now going to be the things that I'm sure we'll end up talking on the programme about incessantly in between now and the next budget coming along? What do you think are the real flashpoints, the real tension points?
Well, I mean, you know, the far right of Marine Le Pen, or the hard right, had its red lines, and they were red lines which were a result of the choices made in the budget drawn up by Barnier. Barnier had, the previous Prime Minister had said, we need to make, you know, we need to shave 60 billion off expenditure, and these are how we're going to do it, by putting up taxes marginally on this and that. And at every time there was a tax that, for example, on electricity, which would hit ordinary people, the hard right, but also the left, said, no, that's not acceptable. I don't see how that's going to be avoidable again, because the bottom line remains the debt and the need to reassure the markets and Europe that France is serious about bringing it down. That will mean restricting the amount of money that the state spends, restricting hands out raising taxes, which, that they are reluctant to do, because one of the great successes of recent years has been the return of business to France. So the circle is still in great need of squaring, and I don't see why Bayrou will find it any easier than Barnier did.
And of course, what all that means, as we know, is that those problems that you talk about get exacerbated the longer that the debt and those issues aren't being addressed. Yeah. The bigger it grows and the more expensive it is to service it. So I guess timeline is absolutely key now, Hugh. And from what you've said, it doesn't sound like this is going to be solved by the early new year, by your assessment.
Well, no. Well, I mean, for a start, there is no budget now. So when the new year kicks in, we'll be operating under emergency laws, continuing the 24 budget, which is symbolically, of course, awful, and it just represents inertia. It's inertia in sort of legislative form. And then looking ahead, yes, I mean, maybe they'll cobble something together, but the question of any significant reforms are absolutely out of the question.
Yeah. Hugh, thanks so much for your time. Hugh Schofield there, our correspondent in Paris. Well, let's look at some of that early market reaction that Hugh was talking about. And Shanti Kellerman, Chief Investment Officer at M&G Wealth here in London, is our financial markets guest on the programme today. Shanti, great to have you as always.
Hi, Will.
Much reaction so far, because it's been, only kind of an hour and a half, 2 hours that we've had this news.
Pretty limited reaction in markets. You saw a very slight rise in the yield, in the interest on the debt, but that's kind of reflects what's happening in the US as well. And a small rise in equity markets, but I think everyone knew this was coming. We've actually seen French equity markets be a bit more positive in the last few weeks, I think, because people are hoping maybe we're at the nadir in terms of the political news coming out.
Yeah, they're not the only ones with meeting that sort of nadir in terms of economic news today, though, are they? Perhaps pick the UK first, and we'll come to Germany in a moment as well. But the UK had a bit of a shock with its growth figures earlier on today.
Yeah, the UK had negative economic growth very slightly, I think. Be a little bit wary of the economic statistics because they can be revised. But the main thing driving it was that consumer-facing services was a contraction, some evidence that people are spending a little bit, waiting to see how some of the tax increases impact them. Because even though a lot of it's been on business, a lot of that may be passed on to individuals as well.
And in Germany, a similar type of warning from the central bank, the Bundesbank, there about, economic stagnation, basically.
Yeah, they also reduced their forecast for growth next year to 0.1%, which is about as unimpressive as you could get. And that economy has been stagnating for a while. There wasn't really a market reaction because it's kind of known. We had the European Central Bank reduce interest rates this week, so hopefully that does ease some of those borrowing costs on businesses and consumers.
Some interesting comments, weren't there, around the German news in particular, but it would affect all three of the big European economies we talked about, and the Eurozone, full stop, actually, too, was about the sort of threat, I suppose, that a Trump 2.0, and in particular big tariffs on imports into the United States, might have on particular big exporter like Germany.
Yeah, it would be negative. I think the positive spin you could have on it is it may actually force Europe to cooperate a bit more across the continent, have a bit more coordinated industrial policy and investment, because if they're going to have to contend with issues like that, they're going to need to probably spend and invest more to deal with the issues.
Yeah, and in terms of that rate decision there, anything that was that kind of came out around the interest rate decision that kind of told you about the direction of travel for the rest of the year in Europe, and similarly what that might mean for other big economies, thinking here in the UK as well, and what we might do with the interest rate here in London, for example.
So in Europe, they're expecting a few more cuts in the interest rate. I think in the US and the UK, it's a little bit more finely balanced, but I think it's likely we'll see a reduction from the US next week.
Really interesting. We'll have some more from Shanti a little bit later on in the programme with some non European business news. But we are going to move, first of all, to the United States. An extraordinary story there, actually. The US is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information about an alleged operation in which North Korean tech workers got jobs as remote workers for American companies and then allegedly stole trade secrets. The scheme, which apparently ran for 6 years, was used to generate millions of dollars for North Korea's weapons programs. Our Asia business reporter Katie Silver explains how US firms have hired North Koreans in the first place.
It hasn't been reported exactly how they got these jobs. We understand that they used stolen American identities, hundreds of Americans, to get hired under the scheme, and that they would often then operate or work remotely from China and Russia. The companies involved haven't yet been identified either, so there's a lot that we still don't know. But what we do understand is that some Americans are also facing indictment, and they're accused of operating what were called laptop farms. So basically, a laptop farm is a scheme where remote IT workers get access laptops that are set up in the United States to appear as if they're completing tasks there. So that may well have been the way it was operated, but as I say, it's still unclear.
Our reporter Katie Silver there with a little bit of the background. Let's get a bit more, though, from Rafe Pilling, the director of threat intelligence, a cybersecurity firm, SecureWorks. Rafe, thanks for being with us on World Business Report.
Great to be here.
So you guys were working around some of the issues going on here. Just explain in a bit more detail what happened.
Yeah, I mean, this is a set of activity we've been looking at throughout 2024. And I should say, although this indictment pertains to a particular subset of this activity, it is ongoing and is an ongoing risk. But the basis of it is North Korean workers are being used to obtain, fraudulently obtain jobs with Western companies. They use either fake or stolen identities to misrepresent themselves as U.S. nationals, or in some cases, citizens from South Korea, China, Japan, Eastern Europe, apply for fully remote jobs. And ideally, you know, if the process goes well, they obtain those jobs and then they seek to draw that salary while potentially getting other jobs at the same time or recommending other workers, other colleagues for jobs at the same company. And the whole thing is about maximizing revenue and revenue generation for the North Korean regime.
And as you're saying, a sense that this is ongoing. Give us a sense of the scale then as well. How widespread is this?
So it can be difficult to prove, but the numbers we're talking about, the FBI cited $88 million in terms of revenue made over that six-year period. There are potentially hundreds, if not thousands, of North Koreans engaged in this activity globally, operating from bases or locations in China, Russia, but potentially other locations in Southeast Asia, and seeking jobs across the West. I mean, yes, the U.S., this is something that affects the UK as well, and really anywhere that they can get high-paying software development or similar jobs, that they will do those.
Right. So these cases being highlighted in the United States, but actually this is an international problem.
Absolutely. Yeah.
In terms of what company, I mean, are there things that companies can do, should be doing, especially if some of our listeners who run businesses, are there any things they should be thinking about?
Absolutely. And it's very interesting because these schemes have really put HR on the front line of cybersecurity, particularly when it comes to protecting from this this sort of textbook insider threat, really. So combining robust hiring practices with good cyber hygiene really reduces the risk that these fraudulent workers are hired and reduces the exposure that organizations experience.
Good cyber hygiene. I like that as a phrase. Just explain what you mean by that.
It's something. The basics of making sure you've patched your systems, making sure you've got multi-factor authentication in place. Those kind of basics that protect against a range of cybercrime activities are also effective in these schemes. Same for making sure you've got sort of appropriate monitoring on your IT equipment. So if something is sent to a laptop farm, as we just heard about, you have software that could detect if settings have been modified, if remote access tools are being downloaded and installed, so that these workers will be operating, as I said, in China and Russia. They will then connect into these laptop farms that are perhaps based in the US, and then do the job that they've been hired to do, while appearing to be based in the US. And as was mentioned, they're assisted by these in-country facilitators.
But and you were talking about HR being on the front line Rafe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are HR departments in many of these firms ready to be in that position? Are big companies, well, and medium-sized ones, I suppose, as well, spending enough money on this still yet? I mean, we hear repeated warnings from guys like yourself who are experts in this area, but have we kind of stepped up globally and tried to try and meet the kind of challenge that's clearly being posed?
I think as more awareness of this particular type of scam grows, people are doing more. The good news is that a lot of it is down to business process. So there's not a huge amount of spend being asked for here. It's thinking about verifying candidates' identities by checking documentation for consistency, including names, nationality details, contact, work history. And if you get multiple applications, looking for overlaps and similarities between applications. In the interviewing and hiring process, making sure you're getting people on video. Ideally, they have to go to some in-person location. Even if you're hiring them remotely, maybe there's an office near them that they can go to and get an identity validation, or you can use a third-party service. Checking for any last-minute changes. So one of the things they like to do is a last-minute change to their address, trying to get hardware rerouted to one of these laptop farms, and also using non-standard banking or money transfer services to get paid. Because they won't necessarily have a bank account in, you know, whatever town they're claiming to be in. And so a lot of these checks combined with post-employment checks to make sure the person that you believe you hired actually is the person that's showing up to the work, can really disrupt and spot these workers in early stage. So a lot of it comes down to process and awareness. I know lots of big organizations out there, particularly in the tech space, are taking this very seriously and are working hard to identify these candidates.
Yeah, clearly.
And weed them out.
Not just a money thing, but a thoroughness issue as well, as Rafe saying there. Really interesting insight. Thanks so much for your time, Rafe. Rafe Pilling there, the Director of Threat Intelligence at the cybersecurity firm SecureWorks. You're with World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Now, techniques used in fracking for oil and gas have unlocked, or could certainly be, a potential source of renewable energy from the Earth's crust that could rival the cost of producing wind and solar energy within a decade. That's according to the International Energy Agency in a new report it has out on Friday. And Hami Bahar is a senior energy analyst at the IEA based in Paris. Joins us live on the programme now. Hami, welcome to World Business Report. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
We went through the very top line of your report there, but in a bit more detail. Tell us what you found.
We found out that there is an incredible technology breakthrough that is happening in the geothermal sector that can basically unlock a potential that is unforeseen so far. And this potential is basically coming from the oil and gas experience, drilling experience more particularly. And geothermal used to be an energy source that is specific to only certain locations. And if we can achieve the cost reduction that we are envisaging through the learnings from the oil and gas sector, we can basically unlock potential everywhere in the world, not only in specific locations. This will mean that geothermal can grow drastically in the coming decade and further.
Just explain a little bit, Hami, before we come to how the tech itself works, perhaps, if we can. But some of our listeners may have heard, we had a piece from Adrian Murray, one of our reporters in Iceland, about this on the programme a few weeks back as well. But geothermal, not perhaps something that people are completely au fait with. So just explain how that works and why people see it as a potentially good answer to some of the questions we've got when it comes to green energy going forward, or greener energy going forward.
Of course, heat below the ground naturally exists, and we can access this heat through drilling under the ground. And it used to be that this heat potential was at high temperatures existing for decades in many locations that we were tapping, such as in Japan, Indonesia, Iceland, and so on and so forth. But when you go deeper in the ground, you have access to higher temperatures and without geography specific. So which means that if we are managed to cost effectively drill further, we can extract the heat from the ground and use it for electricity generation, for heating homes or industrial purposes everywhere in the world. This is how the geothermal works. And what this new technology is doing is basically accessing in a cost-effective way this deeper places of the earth uses this to basically generate energy.
Does it come with any of the associated concerns, environmental concerns in particular, that people have had around fracking for gas, Amy? Is it the gas particularly that is the issue there, leaking into water streams, or is there other things, you know, potentially destabilizing bits of the Earth's crust, making earthquakes more or less likely, those kind of things? Are they potential risk factors with this tech still?
There are risk factors, as you mentioned, seismicity and water contamination and so on and so forth, because these procedures include hydraulic fracturing, like in the shale revolution, or non-hydraulic fracturing. There are other techniques as well. But overall, I think oil and gas sector over time managed to create standards that are basically by the financial sector and by the governments can be observed and watched. We are saying in the report that geothermal sector needs to develop similar standards to be able to inform or create the regulation by the governments, but also the companies need to obey these standards when doing these things. So in terms of this drilling exercises, it has to be obviously in locations where social acceptance are higher, not to disturb people's lives in general. There's the environmental impacts, but there's also social impacts. I think there is a way to manage these that many countries have already done. Best practices are there. We just need to implement them for geothermal, and I think this will be manageable.
Really interesting. More of that report on the IEA's website and on our website, I think, as well. Amy Bahar, thanks so much for your time. Senior Energy Analyst at the IEA in Paris. Well, let's get a quick last look at the markets with Shanti Kellerman, Chief Investment Officer at M&G Wealth. And Shanti, just that we were talking tariffs a little bit earlier. Seemed to have an impact on Chinese stock markets and Chinese government borrowing today again.
Yeah, so today the interest rate that's paid on a 10-year Chinese bond, government bond, went below 2% for the first time ever. So it's kind of a psychologically significant threshold. As inflation is really low in China and also growth has been a bit stubbornly low, they've announced a lot of stimulus, but it hasn't had a lot of impact on consumers actually spending. So that's people thinking that interest rates are going to stay lower for longer and that growth is going to be weaker.
Yeah, something we're going to keep talking about into next week. New tariffs confirmed on some more products by the US today, including things that go into chips once again. So it's going to be something we're going to keep talking about right through the Christmas and New Year period here on the program. Shanti, great as always to have you, your company this afternoon. Mentioning Christmas, just around the corner, big time, of course, for retailers, the most important for many in North America and Europe in particular. And according to the National Retail Federation, for example, in the US, consumer spending set to spike at more than $900 per person for gifts, food, decorations and other items. Elizabeth Hodson's been taking a look here in London at some of those spending habits.
The Spirit of Christmas shopping event in West London is full of festive treats. But how are the businesses behind them faring after a year of supply chain disruptions, rising prices and unpredictable weather? First up is a stall importing Italian favourites to British consumers.
I'm Andrea Magra, the country manager of Cosaporto UK. And during Christmas, our main product is panettone.
Whilst most of Mr. Magra's customers aren't short of a dollar or two, his Dolce & Gabbana panettone costs $55, it's still a delicate balance between making a margin and making a sale.
We try to keep the price as steady as possible, but of course production costs, delivery costs and all the things to bring the products from Italy to the UK cost always much more every year.
Salongo Puraval imports from even further afield. She runs Tate's Cashmere and ships her raw materials from the family farm in Mongolia.
The cashmeres are from goats because we live in high altitude. Goats produce longer fibre, so the quality is completely different than from elsewhere.
Mongolia is the world's second biggest exporter of cashmere. But a weather phenomenon known as Zud meant last winter was one of the harshest on record. Goats shed their coats later than usual, lowering the quality and increasing the cost of raw cashmere fibre by around 10%. So Ms. Puraval was left with a pricing conundrum.
I haven't actually increased the prices last 3 years. Ideally, I have to put the prices up, but keeping my business flowing, I'd like to be fair to everybody, yeah.
But pricing isn't the only hurdle to businesses. Paul Reeder is commercial director of Toymaster, a buying group for 280 independent toy shops in the UK and Ireland.
The consumers wait and see more than they've ever done before. They still haven't really decided until it gets into December. It is really a balance of knowing what to stock, when to buy it. You know, you do hope that you get the numbers right at the end.
And it's not just UK consumers that Mr. Reeder has to consider.
One of the biggest markets for toys, if not the biggest, is the US. If the US suddenly decide they want more of the product, a lot of the availability can be pushed to the US.
And size means buying power.
There is only so much production capacity that any manufacturer can put together. So they use feedback from buyers to hit a number. If that number, say, 100,000, if the US want 30,000 or 50,000, but then suddenly find, actually, no, we don't, we want 75,000, often they can't ramp up the capacity. It's at the expense of everybody else.
But by next Christmas, Mr. Reeder says things could get really serious if President-elect Trump's proposed tariffs mean America imports fewer products.
The US pay for a lot of the technology that goes into making toys. So if the US suddenly decide to buy less toys, there's less money going into the supply chain, there's less money going into the product development, and the whole thing could have a serious knock-on effect.
So whilst you're enjoying this year's seasonal festivities, you might want to spare a thought for those businesses making and supplying the joy.
Slight PTSD in my end at the shopping that I've still got ahead of me. Elizabeth Hodson reporting there from London. Funnily enough, the $55 Dolce & Gabbana Panettone still to appear in the office. Big thanks to our team today on World Business Report. Matt, Maeve and Immy. Mitch has been driving the programme. And to you for listening. Thanks a lot.